it's fine.
So I can take it out?
Yes, no problem. No, you can just... in fact, it's to be more easy, because you need to speak here.
Okay.
But we don't hear anything in your ear.
Okay.
Don't worry.
Okay.
Voilà, bonjour à tous. Welcome to everybody.
Ah, ben voilà, on va faire comme ça, tiens.
So we make some presentation from Rodrigo, who was the DA here. And as you know, in Europe, the main problem is the implementation is like the DA.
Oh, it's too hot to wear my coat. It's too hot. Hi. My name is Robin Gross. I'm Executive Director of IP Justice, and it's really an honor for me to be here today to talk to you folks. Unfortunately, the topic of my conversation is not so pleasant, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act and circumvention laws, what we're going to talk about today. Let me just get a little feel for where people are on this issue. Does everyone here know what circumvention is, or have you heard of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act? Most folks, okay. Right. Well, I'm going to talk about this initially from a U.S. perspective in terms of what is circumvention. Can you hear me okay? Okay. Coming down with a cold, so my throat's a little sore. Well, under U.S. copyright law, all rights that are granted to the authors come with limiting principles, such as fair use or the first sale doctrine for sale privileges that are meant to ensure that copyright holders do not have total control over particular work. Now, in the U.S., copyright law is designed as a means of achieving a public end by providing an economic incentive to create, thus contributing to the spread of an evolution of human knowledge. Under U.S. copyright law, the fair use privilege allows for copying in socially beneficial situations, even when the copyright holder does not wish to allow that copying. Thus, fair use is lawful, but unauthorized copying. Now, other countries have similar principle called fair dealing that also acts as a limitation on the copyright holder's right to control copying. So fair use rights allows you to copy works for personal use, to make archives, backups, educational, academic copies are often found to be considered fair. Well, the fear of technology and the ease with which consumers can copy works in a digital environment has led many IP owners to lock up their works with digital straitjackets, so to speak, to control how the copyrighted work can be used. DVDs, CDs, e-books, and other forms of electronic media use encryption or other types of technological restrictions to control an individual's use of that content. These are sometimes called digital rights management systems, or DRMs, but they don't track copyright law, since they only permit uses that are expressly authorized in advance. These schemes prevent many lawful uses of a copyrighted work. A machine is not capable of identifying a legal versus an illegal copy, and it is a mistake to think that only those copies that are authorized in advance are lawful. In fact, in the United States, the U.S. Supreme Court has been very clear in holding that authorization is not required to make a fair use of a copyrighted work, and that fair use is the necessary breathing space, which enables so that copyright does not conflict with First Amendment freedom of speech guarantees. So these DRMs control schemes entirely replace copyright as the means of mediating the public's access to and the use of creative expression. And these schemes promise authors the power to control access and use, the power to disable fair uses, and the ability to maintain control over a work long after it should have passed into the public domain. In addition to the deployment of these control technologies, Hollywood has requested, and in many countries been granted, anti-circumvention laws with respect to their copyrighted works. Now, this generally means that it's illegal to bypass the technological restrictions that control access and use to these works. Furthermore, in the U.S., under the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, It's illegal to help anyone else to circumvent these digital controls, extending this ban to tools, including software and other information that could tell another how to bypass the controls. Thus, in the US, it is now illegal to access your own property, such as the DVD or CD that you lawfully purchased, in ways that Hollywood doesn't like. There's no DVD playing software for the Linux operating system, and if you tried to build your own player, you'd violate the anti-circumvention laws. The most recent Celine Dion CD is designed to crash your computer if you try to copy it onto your computer, even though courts in the US have held such space shifting to be a lawful fair use under copyright law. And if you try to bypass these controls to space shift or to time shift, format shift the music, you'd violate the Digital Millennium Copyright Act's anti-circumvention laws. So the technology prevents you from engaging in the lawful use, and the law prevents you from circumventing the technology. Pretty clever, huh? Well, Hollywood has been actively lobbying foreign governments to pass anti-circumvention laws, similar or inserting them into numerous international treaties and trade talks, and pressuring countries to pass these laws to make it illegal to circumvent digital controls. Under WIPO, which is the World Intellectual Property Organization, it's a group of 178 countries working to conform their IP law. There were key provisions of the Copyright Treaty and Performances and Phonograms Treaty of 1996 that deal with circumvention. This has been implemented in the United States as the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. What are these WIPO treaty obligations with respect to copyrighted works and technological measures? Well, signatory countries are obligated to, quote, provide adequate legal protection and effective legal remedies against the circumvention of effective technological measures that are used by authors in connection with the exercise of their rights. So that's what the WIPO treaties say. Now, it's important to note that the WIPO treaty does not necessarily require a ban on tools, only effective protection and remedies. The DMCA went unabashedly further, outlawed more conduct and more speech than was required by these international treaty obligations. So there's a very common myth that you often hear put forth by the content industry that countries are required to pass these laws in order to comply with their international treaty obligations. But it's not true. It's really a myth. This level of protection is not required by the treaties. In fact, a Clinton administration official, during testimony before the US Senate, when the DMCA was being considered, admitted to Congress that that the DMCA did not have to go as far as it did not have to outlaw tools, but they simply wanted to go further to set the standard for other countries to try to follow. So this is in the legislative record. So what exactly now does the DMCA do? It was passed in 1998 by the US Congress, and it outlaws the act of circumvention with respect to access controls, and it also outlaws tools of circumvention. And it doesn't matter if it is a copy control or if it is a an access control. There are basically two kinds of controls we're talking about, two kinds of technologies we're talking about, access technologies and copy technologies, copy control technologies. And the DMCA outlaws the act of circumvention, and it also outlaws the tools that are needed in order to circumvent. Now, there are a few exceptions, and they're limited and very narrow. And so far, no one has been able to successfully rely upon them. So what is going on here in Europe is the European Union Copyright Directive, which was passed by the European Parliament and now in the process of being implemented in the various countries. Denmark, Greece, Italy have already passed their implementing legislation, and most of the other countries in Europe currently have a similar bill before their legislatures or their parliaments in their respective countries. And how far does the EUCD go? Well, actually, the EUCD goes even farther than the Digital Millennium Copyright Act in terms of what it outlaws. The EUCD outlaws possessing, making, and providing all tools capable of circumvention. Also outlaws all acts of circumvention without regard to the underlying lawfulness of the act in question. So the EUCD did not have to go as far as it did either. Did not have to outlaw tools and did not have to outlaw legitimate consumer circumvention in order to meet the WIPO obligations, but it decided to go much further. And in some of the countries where the legislation is currently pending, it goes even further than the EUCD requires. So we're seeing more and more and more protection, more and more restrictions, I should say, the further down the line we go. So what's been the U.S. experience with the Digital Millennium Copyright Act so far? Like I said, it was passed in 1998. There have been only a few cases that have been brought, but it's created quite a controversy in the U.S. and abroad, really. One of the biggest complaints launched against the DMCA is that it destroys the private performance rights and the fair use rights and the first sale privileges, because people are not able to use their property in ways that they have in the past, for example, making copies for personal use. The technology won't let you. You can't bypass the technology under the law. So you don't you have fair use rights in theory only. You don't have them in practice. The tools are outlawed, and if you tried to make one, you'd violate the law. So under the DMCA, there's a rulemaking proceeding that the U.S. Copyright Office takes under its purview. And every 3 years, the Copyright Office is supposed to do a study where they solicit comments from the public asking for possible exemptions, for possible examples of things, of acts that should be considered exempt because the law is intruding upon their ability to make lawful uses of their copyrighted works. Well, the study is going on right now in the U.S. It's been 3 years since the law has been implemented, and the U.S. Copyright Office has received hundreds of complaints from individuals all over the country complaining about their inability to play their CDs on personal computers, their inability to fast forward through DVDs or play DVDs on computers that are not authorized by the Hollywood studios. E-books is another form of media that the Copyright Office has received a lot of complaints about. People are not able to transport, space shift their e-books. Computer games is another type of work that the Copyright Office has received a lot of requests for exemption. Software. So there are lots and lots of different kinds of copyrighted works that are being harmed or that are being negatively impacted because people are not able to access their content in lawful ways, and the law is preventing them from doing that. So the U.S. Copyright Office will issue their ruling by October 28th of this year, in which they will determine what, if any, classes of works will be exempt from this general ban against circumvention. another complaint that has been launched against the DMCA in the U.S. is that it's been a powerful weapon against competitors, cases that have nothing to do with copyright infringement. Since the DMCA's ban on circumvention tools is so broad, anyone who tries to build a homemade device or software capable of playing a DVD or other digital media violates the prohibition against circumvention. Thus, the circumvention laws are effectively creating a monopoly over who can build devices capable of reading digital entertainment. And there have been some cases in the U.S. that have been brought under the DMCA. For example, Adobe Software versus the Elcomsoft and Dmitry Sklarov e-book reader case. Have you folks heard of that? Anyone heard of Dmitry Sklarov? Okay, about half. Good, so I get to be the first person to tell you, many of you. Adobe, the way they make their e-book technology is they permit publishers to have control, to set the restrictions on how people are able to access those works. So, for example, there's a feature there where the publishers can decide not to let the books be read aloud, or there's a text to speech capability. For example, folks who are sight impaired need to be able to have their e-books read to them. And so this is one example of a feature that gets often turned off by the publishers. Publishers can decide not to permit any copying of these books, not to even permit you to print out a page to use in a report, all kinds of restrictions. Whatever kind of restrictions you can build into the technology, they're doing it. And the DMCA is sort of legally bolstering these wishes of the publishers, turning them basically into law because you can't circumvent them. Well, there's a Russian software company called Elcomsoft. It's a pretty big, fairly decent size company in Russia, in Moscow, and they make security tools and encryption tools, that sort of thing. One of their biggest customers is law enforcement agencies, particularly the United States. One of the tools that they were working on was building an ebook reader, something that would be interoperable with Adobe ebooks. Dmitry Sklarov was a cryptographer working on his PhD in Moscow, and did some research on the Adobe technology. And then he took that research to his employer and sort of turned it into a project where they decided to create this ebook reader software. Well, Adobe got wind that they had created this software that would permit people to take their Adobe ebooks and view them on other systems, or get it to interoperate in some way. And they weren't very happy about this. And it turns out Mr. Sklarov had been invited to the United States to speak at a conference about 2 years ago, and DEF CON, Las Vegas, and the FBI got a phone call from Adobe, and they said, hey, looks like this Russian software, this Russian cryptographer is going to be in town, and by the way, looks like he also violated the DMCA. You might want to talk to him. So when Mr. Sklarov, after he gave his presentation at DEF CON and was on his way back to the airport to go back to Russia, he was arrested by the FBI in the United States. And he was held for 6 weeks without bail. Subsequently, Elcomsoft, his employer, was also charged under the DMCA. Now, this created a huge backlash. There was a lot of public outcry over the arrest of this programmer for creating this software. There were protests at the U.S. Embassy in various countries. There were protests in San Francisco at the Department of Justice, the offices where he was being charged. There were letter writing campaigns from all over the world where people were writing letters saying, you can't prosecute this man. We don't support the prosecution of this man for writing software that helps people read books. I mean, you know, he faced 25 years in prison was what he was looking at, for writing software that helps people read books. He sounds pretty dangerous, doesn't he? But this is the law. This is the law that we have now. Well, this public backlash really sort of worked out to Dmitry's favor, because the FBI decided they weren't going to be able to successfully prosecute him, and so they decided to cut a deal. Where they said, okay, we'll drop the charges against you, Dmitry. We're only going to charge Elcomsoft. We're only going to prosecute Elcomsoft in exchange for your testimony against Elcomsoft. Dmitry said, sure, I wrote the software. I'll admit to writing the software, but I don't think it ought to be illegal. So this case went to trial. And last year, the jury found Elcomsoft innocent. This was the first criminal case in the United States of the DMCA. And the jury foreman was asked afterwards by the press, you know, what was your reasoning? And he said, we don't feel comfortable with the idea that the publishers get total control over how we're able to use these works. So this is one example of how a competitor really is able to to harass and use this law to try to stop someone from building interoperable systems. There wasn't a charge or of copyright infringement here. Nobody was saying what Dmitry is doing is copyright infringement. On the contrary, it was all about the tools, building tools that could interoperate with the Adobe eBooks. One of the first cases that was brought under the DMCA in the U.S. was against 2600 Magazine. Anyone familiar with this case, the DCSS case? Okay, a few. Well, this was even earlier than the Dmitry case. This case was brought back in 1999, and let me tell you a little story. There's a young Norwegian teenager by the name of Jan Johansson, and he'd gone to France with his family on vacation, and he'd bought a DVD, and when he brought it back home to Norway, it wouldn't play in his DVD player back home. And the reason for this is because of the region coding. Apparently the DVD that he'd bought, or the player that he had bought, was from another region, and so they weren't compatible. And Jan, being a clever young 15-year-old, he figured he could solve this problem with the tools in his head. And he decided to set out to write a software program. There was a group of folks who were working on this project of building a Linux DVD player, an open source DVD player. So there's this project called the Livid List, which stands for Linux Video. And Jan teamed up with this group and a couple other European programmers, someone from the Netherlands and someone from Germany, and reverse engineered the CSS technology. CSS stands for the Content Scrambling System, which is what the Hollywood movie studios use to control the way DVDs can be played and the way DVDs can be used. So they wrote this program called DCSS, which is the decryption of CSS. And this is a necessary component to building a DVD player, because in order to watch a DVD, it's got to be unencrypted. So when this piece of the project was posted onto the Livid List, which was a group of open source software developers working from all over the world to create this Linux DVD player, this got Hollywood's attention. And this is back in the fall of 1999. And Hollywood filed a slew of lawsuits at that time. In the United States, in particular, there was a case, the first case was filed in California under a trade secrets misappropriations case against 70 named individuals and 500 John Does, who had all republished the software on their websites. Another case was filed in New York under the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. And the charge was the posting of this software program is a circumvention device, that the software program itself, DCSS, is a circumvention device. And so by posting it onto the internet, people were trafficking in circumvention devices. Sounds very dangerous, doesn't it? Well, 2600 Magazine, you guys familiar with 2600 Magazine? Yeah? They had been covering this controversy, particularly the case in California, and they had included a portion of the code on their in their publication. And so the next thing you know, 2600 Magazine got sued under the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. That was the case in New York. The Hollywood movie studios were charging that these journalists' publication of the software was illegal under the DMCA, because they were providing information which could help someone to bypass these technological controls, thus in violation of the DMCA. Well, this case went to trial in New York several years ago, July of 2000, and the court in New York found in favor of the movie studios and said, this is a circumvention device and it's outlawed. And not only that, not only are we going to enjoin these journalists from posting the code, we're also going to ban them from linking to other websites that post this software. So this was one of the first cases against linking, where a link had been found to be illegal, an illegal circumvention. This was appealed up to the Second Circuit Court of Appeals, and the Second Circuit Court of Appeals sided with Hollywood again and the lower court judge. And so there's a decision in the United States now that DCSS is a circumvention device and outlawed. Not completely satisfied with their ruling in the United States, Hollywood decided to pursue Jan Johansson in Norway. So they had filed an official complaint against Jan and his father, Per. Per owned the servers onto which Jan had posted, he used to post the software. Although the prosecutors didn't elect to prosecute Per, they did prosecute Jan. And he went to trial last December under a Norwegian economic law, which outlaws bypassing. It's basically a data theft law where you're not allowed to access data that you're not entitled to. And so it's basically this anti-hacking law that had always been used to prosecute people who break into somebody else's bank records or maybe the phone company's records. But it had never before been used to prosecute someone for breaking into their own property, which is what they tried to do here. He tried to access his own DVD in a way the studios didn't like, and so they're trying to stretch this current law to include a ban against accessing your own property under this old data theft law. This trial was last December, and the court in Norway found Jan innocent. However, Hollywood, not to be deterred by the Norwegian court, pressured for an appeal. And the courts have decided to take the appeal, and so his case is going to be retried this December. December 2nd is the date that his retrial has been set for. And Jan could face 2 years under this, 2 years in jail under this law. That's what it calls for accessing his own property. So that's another case that the Norwegian part isn't about the DMCA, but it's another case where we're seeing these circumvention laws either being passed through parliament or trying to get a judicial construction that would include this. More recently, there was a case filed in the US against static control components by Lexmark, the printer company. And static control makes printer toner cartridges that are interoperable with Lexmark printers, and they're a little bit cheaper. So if you were to buy a printer toner cartridge that static control components makes, you could get it to work with your Lexmark printer. Well, Lexmark was not happy about this. They want you to buy the Lexmark printer toner cartridges. So they filed a case under the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, claiming that these printer toner cartridges are circumvention devices because there's a computer program in there that they claim you have to access only with their technology. That's the only authorized way to access it. And so because if you access that printer toner through the static control cartridge, you're in violation of these circumvention laws. Again, there's no claim of copyright infringement here. This is only about controlling who gets to sell printer toner cartridges, basically accessory products, interoperable products. A court recently sided with Lexmark and has enjoined static control components from distributing, from manufacturing and selling these compatible printer toner cartridges. This case is still ongoing. It was a preliminary injunction. So it is, it's still ongoing in the U.S. and it's very hotly contested and closely watched by a lot of legal experts and activists. Well, there are more examples of similar cases in the United States that have been brought under the DMCA. For example, Chamberlain Group has sent a DMCA threat letter to Skylink Technologies over interoperable garage door openers. Skylink makes a universal garage door opener, works with various different manufacturers of garage doors. And Chamberlain Group's not happy about this. They want you to buy their garage door openers. So they sent a threat letter under the DMCA saying these garage door openers are circumvention devices because there's a computer program hidden inside the garage door and hidden inside the opener. And if you try to access that, the contents of that program through a different opener, you're circumventing the access control technologies. And so they have stopped selling these universal garage door openers. Again, it's not a claim of copyright infringement, but we're seeing how these laws are so broad in what they outlaw that they are being used against competitors for selling, manufacturing, and selling compatible, interoperable, and often less expensive products. Well, there are more complaints in the U.S. that have been launched against the DMCA, more than the restriction on fair use rights, more than the anti-competitive nature. People are very concerned about the chilling effect on speech that these laws are having, particularly with respect to scientific research and cryptography. The DMCA's circumvention prohibitions are so broad that they outlaw software or other technical information that could assist in the bypassing of digital controls. So even information that discusses a technology's vulnerabilities has been outlawed by the DMCA's ban on providing circumvention tools. Another case that was one of the first ones to use the Digital Millennium Copyright Act was, let me just sort of back up and tell you a little story about a professor, a Princeton professor by the name of Ed Felton, and his participation in the SDMI Secure Digital Music Initiative. Secure Digital Music Initiative was something that the Recording Industry Association of America put together, the RIAA, and that's the group that controls basically 90% of the manufacturing and distribution of music in the country. Well, the RIAA was trying to come up with a technology that they could use to encode all of their music in and that would control people's use of digital music. So they had several technologies that were their final, that were in competition for the final selection, and they initiated a challenge. They called it the SDMI Hack Challenge, where the recording industry issued an open invitation to the internet community and said, here, try to hack this technology, see what you can do, and let us know. We want to see how it works. Well, Professor Felton and his research team, he had a team of researchers from Princeton, Rice University, were working with him on this project, and they downloaded the technology and they tested it. And what they discovered was that it was remarkably weak, and it was going to be cracked upon its immediate introduction into the marketplace. And they sort of felt like the public had a right to know this, that the musicians had a right to know this. The RIAA was asking all of the country's musicians to buy into this technology, claiming it would protect their interests, asking all of the consumers in the country to buy into this technology. It would control their uses of digital music. And so the professor and these researchers do what researchers do. They wrote a paper about what they had learned about their experience studying this technology and its vulnerabilities. Well, this paper had been accepted for publication at a technical conference, and the RIAA got wind of this. They had found out. And so they sent Professor Felton a threat letter under the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, claiming that his paper, his presentation at this conference was a circumvention device because he was, I know it's funny, but it really it's not, claiming that because this paper would tell someone how to bypass these controls, it would provide information that could tell you how to circumvent these controls, that it was a circumvention device in violation of the law. The professor, being a smart man, knows that you take threat letters from the recording industry very seriously. And it wasn't just Professor Felton who received the threat letter. It was every researcher on the team. The universities that they work for were also threatened, and the organizers of the conference where he was to present this paper all received threat letters under the DMCA. So Professor Felton was a little nervous about this, and they decided to pull the paper a couple days before its presentation rather than risk prosecution from the recording industry. This letter was made public. This threat letter was made public. It had been circulated on the internet pretty widely. And again, there was quite a backlash against the RIAA for threatening this Princeton professor in this manner, and all the researchers with litigation if they were to present this paper. So at that time, scientists, researchers all over the world were really getting nervous and really becoming more and more concerned about would they be able to continue in their research, would they be able to continue to write about and talk about what they'd learned. So the Electronic Frontier Foundation filed a declaratory judgment suit on behalf of Professor Felton and these researchers, asking the court to rule that they had a free speech right to publish this information, to publish their paper and what they'd learned. Well, there was the RIAA had a black eye now. They were, there was a case before the court where some of this law could be curtailed some. There was a whole lot of public backlash for threatening the professors. And so they said, oh, okay, we're sorry. We never meant to threaten the good professor. And if we did mean it then, we don't mean it now. So we take it back. So the RIAA agreed to let Professor Felton give this presentation and this paper at another conference coming up. And they did that. However, the RIAA said, we reserve our right to sue you guys if you talk about it in any other ways, or if you use this research in the future, or for some other paper gets published. We reserve our right to sue you. So really, the threat wasn't over. It was just over for that one particular paper at one particular conference. So that case ended up going away because the paper was able to be presented, but it really did sort of raise the awareness of the press, and particularly of programmers and cryptographers and other computer professionals all over the world about the dangerous possibilities that they face by continuing with testing and talking about certain technologies. There was another incident where a U.S. computer giant, Hewlett-Packard, they used the DMCA to threaten a group of researchers who had published information about the operating system security flaw that HP had known about but never fixed. Well, the computer security researchers, they're particularly vulnerable to the DMCA violations, since they regularly circumvent the security of computer systems for testing purposes. It's their job. And in another incident, Hewlett-Packard employee and Linux guru Bruce Perens was forced to pull his presentation at the last O'Reilly open source convention because it would have involved bypassing DVD access controls and thus risking DMCA liability. Hewlett-Packard ordered Perrins to withdraw his demonstration on how to get around the DVD region code restrictions and subsequently fired him from Hewlett-Packard. Alan Cox, a top Linux developer in the UK, had announced that Americans would not be given technical information about security patches in an update to operating systems, since it could trigger DMCA liability for the open source developers. So American developers and scientists and other countries who have also passed these circumvention laws are at a significant competitive disadvantage now. In terms of being able to freely discuss technical information. Well, the DMCA's chill felt on scientific research and publication extends to researchers outside the US as well. Several foreign prominent scientists have issued statements saying that they're afraid to travel to the United States because some research that they have done in the past or a computer program that they have written could help someone to bypass access controls, thus creating DMCA liability. And if they came to the United States, they might be arrested for distributing this circumvention device. A noted Dutch cryptographer has issued a statement that he is withholding research on video encryption out of fear of DMCA liability for releasing that information. Technical conferences are moving overseas and relocating to jurisdictions where circumvention bans have not been passed. Organizers and sponsors of technical conferences face criminal liability under the DMCA for circumvention, since they provide the technical information for a profit. If you pay to get into a conference, for example, where this information is distributed, there's a commercial commercial component to that. To that transaction, and that triggers the criminal liability for conference organizers. Following the arrest of Dmitry Sklarov for revealing the weaknesses in Adobe's software, the state of Russia's State Department issued an official travel advisory warning Russian computer programmers about the dangers in traveling to the United States since the DMCA was passed. Well, now that we've had an opportunity to really have a few years of the DMCA being implemented, Americans are starting to think twice and reconsider these extremely broad prohibitions and beginning to pressure lawmakers to reform this law. And the U.S. lawmakers have, a couple of them, not many, a couple of them, have begun to respond to this growing public opposition to the DMCA's circumvention prohibitions in the U.S. Efforts have begun in the U.S. to revise the DMCA in Congress, the Copyright Office, and the courts. Even the executive branch officials have become publicly uncomfortable with the DMCA's extreme ban on consumer circumvention and scientific speech and research. So in the U.S., there have been a couple legislative proposals that have been put forward to reform the DMCA. One that was recently introduced is called the Benefit Authors Without Limiting Advancement of Net Consumer Expectations, or the Balance Act. And this was introduced by Representative Zoe Lofgren, a congresswoman in California. Now, what this act would do, it would modify the DMCA's anti-circumvention rules by allowing a user to circumvent technological safeguards if it is necessary for a non-infringing use and if the copyright owner does not make that non-infringing use publicly and freely available. Additionally, this act would reverse the DMCA's ban on the manufacture, import, offer, and use of circumvention devices if they are necessary to effectuate such a non-infringing use. So this is one piece of legislation that is currently pending before Congress in the United States, which could take some of the teeth out of the DMCA's anti-circumvention laws. There's another act that has been proposed, the Digital Media Consumers' Rights Act, DMCRA. And this has been proposed by Representative Rick Boucher and John Doolittle and Spencer Baucus. Interesting enough, Rick Boucher has been one of the most vocal opponents of the DMCA since it was passed. So there's just a handful of people in Congress now who are beginning to wake up and realize what they have done. The DMCRA, Boucher's bill, is identical to one that he introduced last session, and there are three main components to this bill. Firstly, it reaffirms fair use rights. The fair use standard should be applied to digital works by allowing circumvention for a legitimate fair use. Second, it reestablishes the Betamax standard by stating that it is not a violation of the DMCA to manufacture, distribute, or make non-infringing uses of a copyrighted work. In the United States, the Betamax case stems from it's a famous 1984 Supreme Court decision where the Hollywood movie studios sued the manufacturers and importers of VCRs back in 1979, claiming that these VCRs are tools of infringement because people are going to use them to copy copyrighted works in their entirety without permission. They must be outlawed. And this is what the Hollywood movie studios argued before the courts in the United States. And this case was filed in 79. It wasn't decided until 1984 by the U.S. Supreme Court, and the court decided in a 5-4 decision that VCRs should be legal, that you can't outlaw technology just because it is capable of infringement, that if there are substantial non-infringing uses for a technology, it should remain lawful under copyright. And so this has been called the Betamax doctrine, the Betamax standard ever since, and it's sort of been the watermark for how to balance the rights of copyright owners against technological innovation, and it has been under threat ever since the DMCA was passed, because now we're outlawing tools of circumvention that is contrary to the Betamax standard, tools that have substantial non-infringing uses. Well, this voucher bill does one more thing. It amends the DMCA to permit scientific research into the technological protection measures, since that's been one of the biggest complaints, is how researchers are not able to do their research. As I mentioned before, even the U.S. executive branch is calling for DMCA reform. Not terribly loudly, but last October, the head of White House cybersecurity, Richard Clark, called for DMCA reform due to its chilling effect on computer security research. Clark said that researchers should be allowed to share information about computer vulnerabilities, but the DMCA's circumvention prohibitions made their publication flaws illegal. So even the Bush administration officials said threats made under the DMCA against researchers has been a misuse of this law, and that reform is needed. In 2000, the U.S. National Research Council published a report that criticized the DMCA and recommended revising its circumvention prohibitions to provide for legitimate consumer circumvention. Oops, excuse me. Well, the U.S. courts are even wrestling with the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. There are legal challenges going on in the courts as well. A case that's going on right now, as we speak, involves 321 Studios. 321 Studios makes DVD copying software. So if people are able to space shift their DVDs or watch them, archive them, make backups of them, that sort of thing. But again, the Hollywood movie studios don't want you to be able to have that kind of capability. So they sued 321 Studios, claiming that these software programs are circumvention devices. And this case is currently pending before a federal court in California. The 321 Studios has asked for a ruling in the case as well, that their software is non-infringing, should be lawful under the Betamax standard. The judge that heard oral argument on this case about a month ago, she hasn't issued a ruling yet, but during the oral argument, she said she was fairly persuaded by the Hollywood Movie Studios position and the 2600 case that went before it, that they're likely to win. She's leaning towards ruling that the software is illegal. An official ruling is expected sometime before July 15th on this case. It's being very closely watched, very, very hotly contended. There was another case that was going on in the U.S. courts. It was recently dismissed, but I think it's worth talking about. There was a Harvard researcher by the name of Ben Adelman, and the kind of research he does has to do with websites that are blocked by blocking filter software, where they try to block access to certain websites, and oftentimes they're inaccurate in terms of what they actually block access to and what they claim they block access to, these kinds of programs. And Professor Adelman, he regularly researches this issue and reports about how accurate these programs actually are and what they actually do and what they claim to do. Well, during the first rulemaking proceedings of the U.S. Copyright Office 3 years ago, the Copyright Office issued an exemption that would permit researchers such as Adelman to be able to bypass technological controls on lists of websites that are blocked. Well, you think, wow, that's great. Well, the problem is the tools are still outlawed under the DMCA. So even though Mr. Adelman has a specific exemption to permit him to do his research, there are no tools that are allowed, that are legal for him to use. And so Professor Adelman, together with the ACLU, the American Civil Liberties Union, filed a lawsuit in the United States asking for the court to rule that he should have a right to these tools, since it's a little bit illogical to say you've got a right to do this activity, but we're going to outlaw the tools that are necessary for you to engage in that activity. Unfortunately, the court dismissed the case against Mr. Adelman. Said there was no threat, he had no standing to sue. So just case dismissed, gone away. That was a little disappointing. So the U.S. has begun to rethink the DMCA in the Copyright Office, in the courts, even in the Congress. The Congress is rethinking, trying to think about how to reform this law. There's a lot of money and there's a lot of resources on the other side here. I mean, Hollywood has a very close connection with Congress, and when Jack Valenti, who's the president of the Motion Picture Association, when he calls the senators, they take his call. He's one of the few people that they will take his call. They will take someone's call. But that is how important he is in terms of the amount of power and influence that this industry and this man represents. So we really are facing an uphill battle, even though the public is beginning to become aware of the problems of the DMCA. It really is an uphill battle to try to get, for example, Congress to change the law in a way that will be helpful and meaningful to real consumers. Well, in addition to the controversy in the United States, there's growing international concern over these circumvention prohibitions. Observers all over the world have signaled mounting discomfort with these broad prohibitions against legitimate consumer circumvention. But the U.S. copyright industry is really pushing on the international community to pass these laws. The U.K. Commission on Intellectual Property Rights issued a report last summer calling attention to the threat that these broad circumvention bans, such as the DMCA and the EUCD, have created for consumer rights. And the UK Commission on Intellectual Property Rights actually recommends legislation that permits circumvention to engage in lawful use of digital media and warns other countries against passing circumvention prohibitions such as those in the DMCA and the EUCD. Recently, the Canadian government issued a study. It's published on the Canadian Copyright Office's website, also recommending against the passage of circumvention laws in Canada, which is an issue that's being debated in Canada right now. Local populist groups are springing up all over the world to defend consumer rights and fight against these circumvention laws in various countries. Interestingly, EFFI, Finland, Electronic Frontier Finland, was successful earlier this year in defeating that country's EUCD implementation. There was a real grassroots effort that they had got going, and they were able to convince the committee that was considering the bill to turn it down because it would be so damaging to consumer rights and legitimate consumer activity. So I think that the case of Finland really demonstrates the power of grassroots organization and mobilization to try to push back against some of these laws in different countries that are currently pending. So in closing, I want to encourage you all to spread the word, educate the people, write letters to the editor, educate the press, lawmakers, courts, everyone on this U.S. experience, so you don't make the same mistakes that we have made in the United States in terms of outlawing so much legitimate activity. So that's really all I had prepared to talk to you about, but I'd be happy to answer any questions on this subject if you've got them. Anyone have any questions? The DMCA is very clear, right? Yes. I'm sorry, could you say that again? It's possible. I don't know how the technology works in those cases, but if Microsoft considers there to be an access control that only its software implementation, that only its Word program is authorized to open, then yes, trying to open those programs with something else would be considered illegal in the U.S. or other countries that have passed these laws. It's really, I'm glad you brought up that point, because there are so many things that people use every day that can be outlawed now, that are outlawed now by these laws. For example, there are some CDs that are copy protected, and if you take a black marker and just draw a circle on this CD, to block out certain data, you basically have bypassed those technological controls because it blocks out the ability to the message that says don't play. And so in theory now, these black marker pens could be our circumvention devices in the United States. Pardon me? I'm taking my chances.
What about the next search engines?
Pardon me?
What about the search engines? Are they considered illegal?
Well, there haven't been cases where search engines have been considered illegal, but we've already seen a case where a link to DCSS has been considered a circumvention device. So you could then say, well, if Google decided to link to it, that would be an illegal circumvention. Some DVDs are being distributed now in such a fashion that they will destroy themselves in 48 hours. And the idea is you they're sort of vacuum packed, and when you open them up, they become oxygenated, and that's the process by which they destroy themselves in 48 hours. And this is some part of the Hollywood movie studio's new plan to combat piracy. Well, it turns out that nitrogen could be considered a circumvention device, because some people are talking about building DVD players or CD players in a vacuum chamber with nitrogen inside of them. So if you, so you could open them up in this closed environment, and they would not become oxygenated. So nitrogen is a component, which the statute includes components, outline components. So nitrogen is a circumvention device in violation of the DMCA. Pardon me? Well, you're lucky.
I just wanted to do a comment about Google, because DMCA was one of the reasons for Google to implement country-based filtering. Mm-hmm. And they have responded to the DMCA threats, removing links from the results of Google for the United States citizens.
Okay. Mm-hmm. That's not a surprise. Yeah. Any other questions or comments on this? Yeah. There is a law called the Audio Home Recording Act that was passed in 1996, and it created a tax on digital audio recording devices and digital audio recording media. It's been the statute defines it very narrowly with respect to DAT, mini disc technologies. So there are taxes that are paid. I believe it's 2% of the transfer price. That it's a tax that's attached to the cost of the devices themselves, your DAT player, as well as the media that you would use. And CDs that are considered audio-only CDs are also included under the Audio Home Recording Act. And so those also have a tax that is added to them. It's not the majority of media, however. The majority of the Audio Home Recording Act specifically exempted computers and general purpose devices from this tax. And boy, was the RIAA really mad about that. But that was a condition that they had to meet in order for the computer industry to say, okay, we're not going to fight you on this bill. Computer industry is pretty big too, and they didn't want to fight the computer industry, so they got a nice little carve out for computers and more of general purpose technologies. Interestingly, though, they sued Diamond Multimedia when MP3 players first came out, claiming that they should be regulated under the Audio Home Recording Act. The court threw that case out and said no. For one thing, computers and computer peripherals were specifically exempted from that law, and for another thing, consumers have a fair use right to what they called space shift their music from their CD player to their MP3 player, for example. And so that's a very important case in the U.S. with respect to standing up for consumer rights to copy digital music. Most computer devices are not considered under or not under that law. Yes?
Could you tell us more about
that? I'd be happy to. in fact, on Saturday, I'll do a whole speech about IP justice. I was a former attorney with the Electronic Frontier Foundation, an intellectual property attorney, and founded their campaign for audiovisual free expression in 1999. And a lot of the work that I was doing had to do with going around to different countries and talking to people about copyright law and the laws in the US and the laws in their countries. And I was really sort of struck by how everyone in different countries were really expressed a frustration about the lack of coordination between groups in different countries, and the need for something like that. And so I really did see a need to try to get groups in different countries to work together, to share knowledge and to share resources. So I earlier this year, I left the Electronic Frontier Foundation to found IP Justice to continue to work on these issues, but in an international context, and try to build coalitions amongst groups in different countries, and we can share knowledge and we can share resources, get a common agenda to really sort of begin to push back at an international level against the this constant ratcheting up of intellectual property holders' rights at the expense of consumers' rights. So IP Justice is a 501c3 nonprofit organization in the United States. I'm the founder and executive director. We really try to work towards finding a good balance, an appropriate balance for IP laws that is fair to creators, it's fair to consumers, doesn't go too far in one direction or another, but really tries to find a way that we can encourage further creativity while we get artists paid. I think we all want to get artists paid, but the current model certainly isn't doing that. The recording industry, for example, yesterday they were successful in killing a bill in California, which would have obligated them to have a fiduciary obligation and responsibility with artists in terms of paying them the actual money that they owe them in the recording contracts. They didn't want that responsibility. they decided to kill that bill. So the current model is not working for getting artists paid, and it's certainly not working for protecting consumer rights or encouraging further innovation and creativity. So, you know, we're really trying to find a way that will be fair to all sides and will be in the best interest of the public, and really trying to look at what's in the public's best interest rather than, you know, the Hollywood balance sheets viewpoint of how copyright law should work. So some of the things that we've done so far with IP Justice, I've participated in the U.S. Copyright Office hearings, testified last month, asking the Copyright Office to exempt DVDs and CDs and ebooks from this general ban against circumvention. they'll be issuing their ruling by October 28th of this year. In May, I went to Italy and spoke with the Italian Green Party, trying to encourage them to get fired up about intellectual property issues and to take up intellectual property issues as a party platform to try to defend consumer rights. So those are the some of the kinds of activities that we've been doing. One of the things we're focusing on right now is the Free Trade Agreement of the Americas, which would basically impose DMCA rules for all 50 countries in the Western Hemisphere, without any exceptions or limitations whatsoever. So there's a lot of work to be done with respect to circumvention and protecting the consumers' rights. And so this is really our goal and the kind of things that we're working on. also on the board of IP Justice is John Gilmore, who's one of the founders of the Electronic Frontier Foundation. He was employee number 5 at Sun Microsystems and has been really active in defending civil liberties in the digital arena for over a decade now. Another attorney on the board is Alon Levy, who is the attorney who recently won the Pavlovich DCSS case in the California Supreme Court and the U.S. Supreme Court. We've got some very distinguished international board with an Italian law professor, Giovanni Zicardi, is also on the board. He's in Milan University, a digital intellectual property specialist, and also a Swiss doctor by the name of Martin Spirig is also on the IP Justice Board. So that's a little bit about some of the work that we've been doing and who we are and what our goals are. If you want to come back to my talk on Saturday, you can get a bigger earful about IP justice and the kinds of things that we're doing. We issued these principles of IP justice where we've asked people to sign on to them. They're posted on our website. Basically, there are principles saying things like, you know, we have a right to make a private personal use copy of things that works that we lawfully acquire. And the tools that are necessary to engage in our lawful rights should be legal. I mean, it seems kind of common sense, but apparently our legislatures need to be reminded that there's some contradiction here in the law, and we expect them, that we demand that they stand up to Hollywood and defend consumer rights. So I would encourage folks to take a look at those principles and sign on to them. We're a membership-based organization, so I hope you will join. And I've got membership forms with me if you're interested. Did anyone else have any questions? Yes. Are people working on open source for? Well, open source and seems to be very much incompatible with what the copyright industry is really trying to do here.
The laws of nature are incompatible.
I agree. Well, no, I agree. But what I'm trying to say is, you know, open source is about people taking apart the technology, figuring out how it works, making it better, improving upon it. These proprietary technologies, you can't take it apart without violating the access controls. So there's a real tension here, and open source development is threatened by these circumvention laws. So, you should be very concerned if you're an open source software developer about your potential liability under circumvention. Any other questions? Thank you.
Speech of Robin in the closing session of the morning.